All right. I got a haircut today, by the way. Because I heard Lori T was gonna be here. I wanted to look good. So Lori, everybody, let's give Lori T a great big round of applause.
Hi, my name's Lori. And I've been in Al-Anon 26 years. I'm very excited, first of all, to be speaking here tonight. It's a great group. I want to thank Jared for recommending me to this group. And I want to take you down the story of my experience, strength, and hope, how I got here, and with the help of Al-Anon, what I'm like today. So, 26 years, I thought I married a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It turned out he was still married to somebody else. But we went to Las Vegas and we got married at the Little White Chapel, or one of those chapels. And we bought a wedding ring on my credit card. And we flew there on my credit card. And we paid the bills on my credit card. And yada, yada, yada. And so we moved into his apartment. I had a single studio apartment, and he had an apartment with his son, his grown-up son. And so what happened was his son moved to my studio apartment, and I moved into that apartment. We didn't do that until we got married. And only then did I discover a bill full of drawers that weren't. Well, let me go back. He had a parrot. They had a parrot. And this parrot would herald in the morning, and parrots are really obnoxious. So it would, and they would throw things at this bird, quiet the bird. And so the bird would bite you if you got near it. The bird was hostile. So this was Hanukkah, Christmas time. So we took a picture of him, me, and the bird, and sent it out as our holiday cards. And so I decided, I came in perfect, and I got worse. So I decided I was going to teach this bird, you know, how to interact with human beings. So I asked this fella that I thought I married, where did you get that bird? And he said to me, oh, it's a pet shop, you know, and the pet shop was around the corner from where we were living. And so I took the picture of him, me, and the bird into this pet shop, and I asked the woman, I said, you know, I have this parrot, and what do I need to do to make it friendlier? And she said, what does the bird look like? And I showed her the picture, him, me, and the bird. And she said, that bird is still my bird. It was never paid for. And I did what any Al-Anon person would do, is I wrote a check for $250 and I paid for the bird. To make a long story really short, in 6 months' time, I was paying alimony to his ex-wife, which was like $3,000 a month. It was not his ex-wife. He never divorced her. So I was paying $3,000 a month to her. I had bailed his son out of jail. He was driving a brand new car in my name that he wasn't making payments on. And we had to go to the AA Al-Anon Roundup in Palm Springs, which he did every year, on my credit card. So we went to the Al-Anon AA Roundup in Palm Springs, and that's where I met my first Al-Anon person. And I said to her, can I ask you a couple of questions? This is a guy who was sober in AA, and he was a speaker. And so she said to me, come back with me to my hotel room while I change into my bikini. I said, okay, because she was going to go lay by the pool. And in 15 minutes in a hotel room in Palm Springs, that lady gave me my life. She said to me, why are you making payments on that car? Because he wasn't making payments or insurance payments on the car. She said, why are you paying for it? I said, why? She said, why don't you sell it? I said, if I sell it, how will he get around? She said, that's not your problem, that's his problem. And she said, why are you paying alimony to his ex-wife? I said, because if he doesn't pay his alimony, they'll arrest him. And she said, that's right, they'll arrest him, they won't arrest you. She said, honey, We've all done that, and you need us. And they call it, you know, that moment of clarity that I knew my thinking didn't work, and somewhere I learned how to fix things that I didn't break and take responsibility for things that were not mine. And I wanted what that woman had, because I knew that woman had gone through the same war I was going through when she came out the other side. And I took the first three steps of this program in 15 minutes in that hotel room. I realized I am powerless, that a power greater than myself, which was that woman changing into her bikini in a hotel room in Palm Springs, that was a power greater than myself that restored me to sanity. And I became willing to turn my life over to the care of a higher power, because I knew my best thinking got my life unmanageable and I was with a stranger changing into a bikini in a hotel room. So I knew my thinking didn't work. So this sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous was sitting before, I think the speaker, the AA speaker meeting, or he was sitting at a table, I remember that. And he was sitting in his bubble of serenity waiting for the meeting to start. Now, I've only been gone 15 minutes. And I walked up to him and I said, all the bills that were yours before I met you are yours again. If you miss one car payment or one insurance payment on the car, I will sell it. I will no longer bail your son out of jail. I will no longer fix things that you break. And I said, have a good meeting. And I walked out the door. He followed me around the whole weekend in Palm Springs. He did. He tried to talk to me. And I would just hang out with those women at the pool because I didn't know what to say. And when I got back to North Hollywood, which is where I lived at that time, there was a North Hollywood Medical Center Sunday night meeting, which Willie will remember because I've known Willie. I sang at Willie's wedding. Been around a long time. And when I got to the point, I told everything. When I got to the point that I said, and we're not even married, the people in that room fell out of their seats laughing. I went and I had that marriage annulled. And there was a bomb scare during the middle of the annulment. And the judge said, hey, these happen all the time. I'm willing to stay if you're willing to stay. And we stayed and I got annulled. Very true. One of the things that they taught me so many things when I first came here, my little baby steps, the things that I learned, which is, see if S on his forehead, if he's talking, say he's sicky, 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 sick. He's sicky, 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 sick. Don't react. It says in the One Day at a Time book, the gods first make angry those they want to destroy. And it says in that One Day at a Time book that alcoholics believe themselves to be gods, and they will make you angry. They could play me like a Steinway. Absolutely. Knew which. He used to say to me, you are so selfish. And I go, no, I'm not selfish. Here. And he'd go, you are so selfish because I would keep giving. Because, which I learned about my four step, somewhere inside of me, I believed what he was saying was true, that I am selfish and that's not a good thing. And where did I learn that, you know? They also told me here, if you run from it, you're destined to repeat it. So I made a decision never to run from anything again, to stay exactly in whatever kettle of fish I was in, and watch myself change my reaction, have the courage to change my reaction. And I watched myself grow up. I promised I would not run. So I used to come home from meetings. And when he was still there, I went, you know, and I couldn't sit next to him on a sofa. Do you ever see those movies or the cartoons where the wolf is sitting with the knife and the fork and the napkin on, and he says, come here, little lamb, you know? That's exactly what he looked like to me, because he could carve me up. He had so much power over me, this guy. It was cunning and it was baffling, and I was way over my head and I didn't know what to do. So at first, what I would do is I'd come home from the meeting and he'd be sitting on the sofa and he'd say, come over here, and I would stay standing. And I would say, I'm sorry you feel that way. They taught me to say, I'm sorry you feel that way. Or you may be right, but I'm not changing my mind. Or, I mean, there was a whole group of things, Al-Anon 101. And then I would say, I gotta go make a phone call now. And I would run and call, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do. And I would be able to talk to that person on the phone until he went to sleep, which would buy me another night, until I could get to another Al-Anon meeting so I could get some more help. Eventually, he said to me, if you don't stop this, you're gonna find yourself alone. Oh, I have to tell you, I sold the car. Oh, there was a, wait, a brand new car. Listen to this, a brand new Mazda with a turn it over bumper sticker on it, you know, a bumper sticker, which he put on that brand new car in my name that he wasn't making payments on. And I obsessed all night long how I was gonna get that bumper sticker off there before I sold it. But I sold the car, and you know what was so interesting? He borrowed his daughter's car. And he fixed it for himself. And I thought, now, isn't that interesting? And then there came a day when he said to me, if you don't stop this, you're going to find yourself alone. And my Achilles heel is my need to be loved and in love. That's a really important part of my life. I want you to like me. I want you to love me. And my fear is if I say no, the world will fall apart. You'll hate me. You'll leave me or whatever. When I didn't have the courage to say, no, let's not run my credit cards up to the tippy top and not pay them off. No, let's not have me sign for that car. No, no, no. I didn't have the courage to say those things. So he said to me, if you don't stop this, you will find yourself alone. And then I said, then I will find myself alone because I'm never going to take care of a 44-year-old man again. I'm not going to do it. And he rolled out a brand new Sears Kenmore refrigerator on a dolly, still owing $3,000 on my Sears card, and he went back to his wife. When I walked back into that apartment, I can remember my footsteps echoing off the walls because it was so empty. He had taken so much stuff with him when he left. And my sponsor said to me, it's been taken out of your hands. Because I didn't leave. I just changed my reaction and I got rigorously honest. And I didn't want to take care of a 44-year-old man. And I watched myself grow. I moved back into that really small apartment. And for the first year I was in Al-Anon, all I did was read Al-Anon literature. And I went to 4 meetings a day. Because I was willing to go to any lengths because I knew my thinking didn't work. And La Cañada was an important part. I used to come to meetings at La Cañada. There was a great, and I think it was a Friday night meeting at the Church of the Lighted Window, which I understand people don't call it the Church of the Lighted Window, but that used to be they would start with pressing problems, and I always had a pressing problem, and I would learn so much because they would answer the pressing problem. And so I spent a lot of time here, and I was really grateful to this place. And you can go to 4 meetings a day. You just have to drive a bit. Thank you. And so the first year I did that. By December the first year, now I was a lot in debt by this guy. By the end of my first year in the program, I came in June 7th, 1986. Willie just figured out the math. And so by December of that year, I had all my debt paid off. And I had, before that, Halloween. It was Halloween. I had, it was Christmas. All right, it was Christmas. I gave 13 sweatshirts for Christmas that said Lori's Friend on it. And they were all Al-Anon people. By the next year, Halloween, I had 100 people at my Halloween party. And I truly believe, if you're a member of this program, you never, ever, ever have to be alone, ever. I have been to so many cities and so many countries. I used to tour with, groups. And they would all look for happy hour. And I would go look for an Al-Anon meeting. And once I hooked up with an Al-Anon meeting, from that point on, somebody would pick me up, take me to the next meeting. I was okay. I always had friends everywhere I went. And I've been to some incredibly interesting meetings and incredibly interesting places because I really liked it. Now, after the first year, I took my own, the fourth step is really important. I took my own inventory, and like I said, my Achilles heel is my need to be loved and in love. And what do I really want? You know, I want a happily ever after. That's what I want. But if I accept unacceptable behavior, I get angry, I get bitter, my self-esteem goes down, and somewhere down the line I'm going to get even. I know that from my fourth step, that I accept a lot of unacceptable behavior, which is not rigorously honest, because the truth is, if you need a girl you can holler at, I'm the wrong girl for you. I mean, there's 100 girls out there who love to be hollered at you, but it can't be me, because I get angry, I get bitter, I get resentful, my self-esteem goes down, and somewhere down the road I'm going to get even. So I, very quietly, the other thing is, the fact that I fixed things I didn't break. Once I decided I wasn't going to do that anymore, if I saw someone knock a bottle off a table, it used to be I was the first one to pick it up and put it down, and I don't pick anything up anymore, not a napkin, because my instincts, I want to do contrary action. My instincts was always to fix it, you know, and I got to the point in my life where I said, well, maybe they want that napkin on the floor. You know, who is it for me to decide it needs to be here or whatever? And it's so amazing because it always gets fixed without my help. Always. All right, so I want a fella. That was a big, important part of my life. And I decided I was going to go on this journey. Now, I also made a commitment to myself. I was 32 years old when I met my first person in Al-Anon. And I decided that I really did do this. For 32 years of my life, I lived one way. And so I committed to 32 years of my life, I'm going to live purely this way. And when I'm 64, I'll decide which way's better. So you'll have to stick around to find out. So anyway, I like, you know, I do like to have a relationship. And so through Al-Anon, I learned how to have really a good relationship. And what I did was, I think, one of the first fellas I started dating, he was getting a divorce. I knew he stood up his ex-wife, and I knew he stood up his children because he was a golfer. He would stay on the golf course till after it got dark. But he never stood me up. And what they teach you here is, what's the problem, whose problem is it, and where does the solution lie? Well, the problem is he stands people up. Whose problem is it? His and the people he stands up. So where's the solution lie with him and those people? So as long as he never stood me up, I never said a word. I was aware of it, but I never said a word. Until the first time he stood me up. And he called me and he said, you know, the sun was out and I was on the golf course and yada, 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 yada. But I'm going to head over there now. Oh, wait, I have to go back. This is so cool. He lived in Riverside, California. He called me up because he had given his car to his soon-to-be ex-wife and he had no car. He called me up and he said, can you drive to Riverside to pick me up so I can come visit you in North Hollywood? Now, pain is what the universe gives you when it wants you to grow. This gut, my gut did one of these numbers like this. And I thought, and I said to him, can I call you back? And I called somebody in Al-Anon and I said, he wants me to, they said, Lori, you didn't break that. You don't have to fix that. I went, oh. So I called him back and I said, look, you know, if it takes you, you know, a year to get a car, I'll still be here, you know. He borrowed a car that night and he bought a car in 2 weeks. And I went, oh. The day came when he stood me up for the first time. And he called and said, I'll be there, you know, in the evening. And I had time. And I said, okay, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say. The way I meditate is I go, I don't know what to say. And then I cover my mouth and I wait. And in the preamble to the Obstacles to Success in Al-Anon, it says all Al-Anon discussions should be loving, helpful, constructive, and understanding. And it doesn't say except when talking to an alcoholic. It says all Al-Anon discussions should be loving, helpful, constructive, and understanding. So if I can't say it loving, helpful, constructive, and understanding, I'm going to keep my mouth shut until I can. So I thought, please give me what to say to this fellow who just stood me up. So he gets to my house, and I was able to say to him, you know, if you need a girl you can stand up, I'm the wrong girl for you. I'm sure there's going to be 100 girls out there going to be loved to be stood up by you, but it can't be me. Because in my mind, I'm thinking, I know I get angry, I get bitter, I get resentful, my self-esteem goes down, and somewhere down the line, I'm going to get even. he started to cry and he said, I know I have a problem in this area and I want to work on it. And I thought, we're in recovery together. I thought, oh, this is so exciting. But he called me back the next morning and he said, you know, I've been thinking about it. And he said, the first time I oversleep, you'll dump me. So what's the point? It took me 2 weeks to take his picture off my wall. And I called my sponsor and I said, I should have. And she said, stop. She said, you have no power. You don't have the power to make it happen. And you don't have the power to screw it up. You have no power. The interesting thing, at the end of that relationship, the only thing I didn't have was that man's company. I still had all my money in the bank. I had my self-esteem. I had all my friends. I had my meetings. I had everything. I just didn't have that man's company. And what that man was saying to me is, I want a woman I can stand up. That's what he was saying. And the truth of the matter is, if I'm rigorously honest, I don't want to be stood up. That's the honest thing, you know? And there's lots of fellas. My girlfriend used to say to me, the weekend's coming, dear. And she did. All right, so I'm going to jump way ahead now. Okay, so eventually I met a man who, when I said to him, if you need a girl, you can holler at, I'm the wrong girl for you. He said, I won't holler at you. And he didn't. Eventually, he asked me to marry him. And I said to him, in my rigorous, honest way, I said, if you want to marry me, I don't cook and I don't keep house. So if you want to marry me, I do not cook and I do not keep house. He said, fine, I'll do all the cooking and I'll get you a housekeeper. I'm married to this man 23 years, is that right? And he's my best friend and we have a savings account and he's a great guy. We have two children. Well, let me go back a little bit more. One of my discoveries when I got to this program was, and I did not know this, I grew up in an alcoholic home. I had one fella say that to me one time. He said, your parents are alcoholics. I said, no, they're not. They drank a case of beer every night, and there was always a keg at every party. But I just never put it together growing up. But my brother was a huge, huge, huge drinker. And so after I got here, I called my brother and I said, you know, you come by it on, well, I called my mother first. And I said, was my dad's dad an alcoholic? She said, no, he was just a mean man. She said, but my dad was an alcoholic. And I said, oh, so my mom watched her mom watch out of a window and wait. And I watched my mom watch out of a window and wait. And I was terrified of my dad. My dad was a huge rager. And my brother, I knew he was a big drinker. So I called him up and I said, you know what, you come by it honestly. Grandpa was alcoholic. Mom and dad are alcoholics. And I sent him a big book with a post-it in it. And I said, I know you like to read. I thought you might enjoy this. My brother's sober 25 years now. And he's here visiting me right now, but he had a different engagement tonight, or I would have brought him. But it's really interesting. And you know what? I stopped fixing the lives of alcoholics and turned my focus. They say, take your focus off the alcoholic. Take your focus off the alcoholic. And place it where I do have some power, which is over my own life. So got married. And we have two unbelievable children that were purely raised with Al-Anon principles. Both of my children are, I have a 19-year-old and a 20-year-old. They're huge nationally ranked athletes, huge. And both of them are on full rides to colleges. And when I was 12 years old and I wanted to be what I wanted to be, growing up where I grew up, nobody would help me. You know, I had dreams I wanted to go do, I wanted to go be, and nobody would help me. And I thought, you know what? I live in Burbank, California. I'm focused on my own life. I have great tools. And I can fly my kids anywhere in the country because we live in Burbank. There's an airport. And I want to be for my kids what nobody was for me. They say, let it begin with me. You know, stop the drama, stop the looking out, let's do what we can do. And so my husband and I both supported both these children in their specific dreams. Because I asked both of them, you know, what are your dreams and what do you want to do? And they each picked a sport and they both excelled incredibly because they had parents that were present in their life. And we were very conservative. I'm very conservative. Because I recognize what a slippery slope it is for debt and craziness and saying yes when I shouldn't be saying yes, I don't do that in my marriage. We don't do that in our marriage. And so we have a savings account and we had the means to help these kids. And I'll tell you something, to have a kid on a full ride, both these girls are, two daughters, they're both 6 feet tall, and if somebody will just feed them, I'm ahead. They feed them, they dress them, they fly them, they give them equipment, they everything. It's just been a great thing. Let me see what else. You know, I could talk about the steps. I told you the first three steps I took, which is I have no power. That is the first thing that happens in my mind every moment when I literally go, thy will be done, thy will be done, thy will be done, thy will be done, no matter what I want, because no can be an answer to a prayer as well as yes. And the fourth step is so important because it's a fearless and searching moral inventory of myself. And first of all, the first step with giving your power away, if I have no power, but people, places, and things have no power over me either. I give them my power. So if I see a kite flying in the sky and I go, oh, we used to fly a kite. The kite did nothing to me. It was my reaction to it. The same thing with places. You know, I go, oh, McDonald's. You know, there's a McDonald's on every corner if that's a problem for me. And people, too. People have no power over you. You give them your power because you don't have courage. We don't have the courage to change. And being willing to go to any lengths and willing to lose. I became willing to lose. I became to buy it hook, line, and sinker and go on the journey and be willing to lose. And in being willing to lose, I've gained so much. You know, there are the promises, and I can't tell you all those promises have come true for me. You know, it's great. And then, you know, you have a sponsor or you give your shortcomings. The God box is a great thing, too, to write down, you know, and I always start it with my fear that I'll never be in love, my fear that it will all be horrible, my fear, which is an absence of faith. And so, I those things have become very automatic for me. The way I work the 11th step, that's one of my favorite steps. If it's your will, give me the power to carry it out. We have one of our two daughters who is today, you know, a nationally ranked athlete. When she was 3 years old, a surgeon severed her facial nerve and took her hearing in an operation she did not need. Acceptance is, for me, acceptance is the key. I don't even need to go any further than God grant me a serenity to accept. Just let me accept whatever it is. And I sat down with that little girl and I said to her, you know what? This is your journey. And I don't know why this is your journey, but you have a crooked smile and you wear a hearing aid. And let's go see what we can do with this journey, you know? Let's go to lunch. And all through school, there's actually a parent here whose daughter played with my daughter. She played on hearing teams. And she wears a hearing aid. You would not know that she's deaf. She speaks very, very well. But I look to see, I figure there must be something for a kid who's this athletic. And the cruelty, you know, and I don't think it was intentionally cruel necessarily, but people forgot that she couldn't hear. And so people would make plans and they just wouldn't say, hey, you know, Sarah, we're going to go do this. And so she was left out a lot in hearing teams. And when she was 16 years old, I took her to try out for the U.S. National Deaf Olympic team in volleyball. And she made it. And she was the youngest student ever, the youngest kid to make that team. She's still the youngest one on the team. When I didn't want to make the decision for her how she should communicate, because I'd never had a child that had a hearing difficulty. And so I found a school in Burbank that taught sign language and speech. There are two teachers in a classroom, one who signs and one who speaks. So she had exposure to both mediums. And when she tried out for this U.S. national team, the coach, who is deaf, and the majority of the girls who were trying out that were deaf, all signed and did not speak. And then there were two girls sitting in a corner who didn't know how to sign at all and were raised orally. And my daughter was signing to everybody. She said, "Mom, don't speak, it's rude." I said, "Okay, Sarah, let's go." And she said, "And don't sign." I said, "Okay, Mom, okay." Oh. So she walked up to these two girls and she signed to them and they went, "We don't sign." And she went, "Oh, hi, my name's Sarah." And they went, "Oh." And she was able to bridge that entire team. The coach, who happens to be the coach at the major deaf college in the United States, not only is the coach for the national team, he's also the coach for this college, made her an offer. He said, "You're the future. I've never met anybody that speaks as well as they say you do," because he couldn't hear, "and who signs." He said, "You're the future." And he wanted her desperately at this school. Now, this is a little girl at 3 years old whose, you know, facial nerve was severed and her hearing was taken. And so today she's a sophomore in college. And she just got back from Bulgaria. My husband flew to Bulgaria. We had one that played in Scotland this summer on a big national team, and the other one played in Bulgaria on a big national team. Isn't this an amazing thing when you think of how afraid I was growing up of everything, of saying no, of it's an amazing thing. And it's because I just trust that it's all going to work out. Both my kids say that. That's their mantra. It's all going to work out, Mom. It's all going to work out. And that purely comes from Al-Anon. You know, the things that used to baffle me, you intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you. And so that's pretty cool. And the other kid, you know, again, you know, it was just the same kind of, yeah, okay, that's what you want to do. Let's do the footwork, which is also part of this, is do the footwork. If I go forward to other steps, the 11th step, I was going to say. So sought through prayer and meditation. I told you how I meditate. I just say, "I don't know what to do." And then I keep my mouth shut until I know how to say it, loving, helpful, constructive, and understanding. And the other thing is pray for the knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry it out. And if it's your will that I have a child who has a crooked smile and who's been rendered deaf, but she wears a hearing aid in the one ear that she can wear it in, then give me the power to carry it out. If it's your will that I be afraid, give me the power to carry it out. Whatever it is, just give me the power to carry it out. And that's the way I conduct my life. And then the 12th step is, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I carry this, you know, I practice these principles in all my affairs, and I carry the message. The other things that I think, and it has worked in my life very well, are our common welfare should come first. Our common welfare. We practice these principles in all our affairs. That means in our home, our common welfare comes first. And home needs to be a safe place. It has to be a place you want to come home to. I can remember sitting in the car in the days when the clock on the dashboard ticked. And I can remember sitting out there with that clock ticking, not wanting to go in that house. I did not want to go in there. And so our home is a safe place, and it's a place where my children want to come to, and we have lots of friends, and our friends want to come. And I believe that is so. The other thing is we are fully self-supporting through our own contributions. And that doesn't mean just that. I mean, I am fully self-supporting through my contributions. I love me, I nurture me, I value me, I listen to me, I take care of me. I was an Alateen sponsor for a while, and I had this one girl who never would go to sleep at night because her mom wouldn't be home. Her mom would be out doing what, you know, alcoholics and addicts do, and the little girl would not go to sleep because she was so afraid somebody would knock at the door and she couldn't hear that something had happened to her mom. And I said, "In 13 years of your life, has anybody ever knocked on the door?" She said, "No." I said, "Well, then for 13 years of your life, you could have had a good night's sleep, huh?" I said, "You don't have that kind of parent. You have to make sure you get a good meal and you get a good night's sleep and you take care of yourself by being loving unto me, fully self-supporting. I will take care of myself to the best of my ability. Then I can be unselfish unto you. They say, you know, I used to give from my reservoir. Now I give from the overflow. Because my concept of fear was always, if I give to you, you'll give back. If I love you, you'll love back, you know? And then they said, the only fair is in Pomona. Other than that, there is no fear. So if I give from my overflow, then I'm okay. And I do like doing that very much. Another tradition that I like a lot is, I don't know what it is, because I can't think. But so many of the things that we do, I'll tell you a couple things here, because I have time. I've never had this long to speak, and I'm very excited about it, because I always run out of time. Now I don't know what to say. There's a river that goes by us all the time, you know? There's love, there's hate, there's fear, there's whatever it is. It flows by us all the time. And what happens to us that makes us sick is we go, there's whatever it is that's toxic. There's that alcoholic. Ah! And I grab him here, and I'm pummeling him here. And meanwhile, all of life is still flowing by. The love, the hate, the fear, the whatever. It just flows by. So if I can stop myself from grabbing it, it allows me to continue my life. Take your focus off the alcoholic. And then the other thing I want to say is that there's a monkey sitting up in a tree. It's a proverb. And the monkey's sitting up in the tree, and he looks down, and he sees all these fish swimming in the water, and he goes, and he starts picking the fish up and putting them in the tree. And somebody says to the monkey, why are you picking those fish up and putting them in the tree? And the monkey says, I'm saving them from drowning. So I came to the point where I know I'm not God, and I don't know why those things are in that water. But I'm going to leave him alone, and I'm going to go be a monkey. You know, I'm just going to go live my life to the best of my ability. I'll tell you one other story. So I think the universe has a sense of humor. I really do. And I worked so hard to not react. And when my daughter had this hearing difficulty, and I discovered schools in Burbank would be the solution for her difficulty, we decided to buy a house in Burbank. We bought this house next door to a rager. The scariest human being I had encountered since my father. I would wake up in the middle of the night and my heart would be going, every ounce of my body wanted to run. I was so afraid of this woman, just terrified of her. And they teach you here to act as if. So I come to, I have two little dogs. We'd get these anonymous letters in the mail about how awful we were as human beings. And one of the anonymous letters we got is, you are blatant dog walkers. Other people walk their dogs for enjoyment, but you're blatant dog walkers. I got my husband a shirt that says blatant dog walker on it. But I was afraid. She would trap me in the garage. You know, she'd throw lemons at people. She'd hose people down, all that stuff. The people that sold us the house knew she was there and were terrified of her. And I knew I wasn't going to outwit her. And I knew that it was the universe's sense of humor that they put me next door to that woman. And I thought, thank you. It's an opportunity to grow. And it took a long, long time of acting as if. I always smiled, even when she and her sister would be out on the lawn going like that as I walked up the street. And I would just act as if, you know, and I'd nod. I'd say, hello, hello. And I would forgive her, I would forgive her, I would forgive her, I would forgive her. There came a day when the police used to come to our house all the time. We were on vacation, and we came home from Lake Arrowhead, and we hadn't even been home the whole weekend. And we get a knock on the door from the police department in Burbank. They come all the time. And the police say, your neighbor says you're talking about her. I said, we were in Lake Arrowhead this whole weekend. And I said, are we doing anything wrong? And they said, no. I found a peaceful way to do it. I put up a feng shui mirror, which bounces the negative energy away from your house. And then she called the police and said, my neighbors put up a mirror so they could look into my house. And we had put a 3-foot extension on our wall so that she would stop looking at our house. And the police came and said, your neighbor says you're looking into her house. And I said, well, it's a feng shui mirror, but please don't tell her what it is. And they said, we're not going to go back over there. So I moved it to where she can't see it. So I find peaceful ways to resolve my life. And all my friends, I haven't lost a single alcoholic. They're all still there. My dad died, unfortunately. My mom's still alive. My brother's sober 25 years. My grandfather, you know, he died a long time ago. And I with my children too, I never solve problems I don't need to. One of my favorite things to say is, let me know how that goes. Go ahead and, you know, let me know. You can handle that. Let me know how it goes. And I just send them away. I don't fix things I don't break anymore. And I think that's one of my luckiest things that I learned in Al-Anon. And I think I've run out of things to say. Thank you so much.